Morning, everyone. I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Kamerlingk. He is a pain management specialist, and he is an excellent addition to our community. He's a member of American Society of Anesthesiologists and Regional Anesthesiologists, and he trained at Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital. Very long CV and lots of good stuff and lots of awards, so we don't have time to go through this or we'll be done with the lecture. So anyway, Dr. Kamerlingk.
Good morning, everybody. So my topic is non-opioid pain management. I think this is, everyone here has been in the hospital. Everything is always talking about opioids, the E-Force, all the regulation, the 3-day, the 7-day, the 30-day. Being a pain specialist, I'm still really concerned about the legislation. It really still doesn't make a lot of sense to me. What the rules and regulations, I think the impetus behind it makes sense, but the enforcement is still very much in the air. So I'm in the same boat as everybody else. I don't really quite understand it, but I think that it's really shedding light on the fact that we should be using other things aside from just giving opioids. I see some of the residents here. I gave a lecture to them, I think it was 6 months ago. This is probably a new crop of residents, and we talked about a lot of these opioid medications last time. But anyway, let's talk about all the non-opioid medications that we can use. So here's the complete list of the non-opioid medications we have, from Tylenol, NSAIDs, neuroleptics, gabapentin, Lyrica, the tricyclic acids, which is a much older type of medication. I'm sure that the attendings here are much more familiar. The residents probably have not heard of a lot of these medications. They've kind of fallen out of the favor probably in the last 10 years or so because of the newer antidepressant agents, the SSRIs, SNRIs. And the last class of medications that I utilize a lot are muscle relaxers, and then obviously interventional pain management strategies. Now, in the hospital setting, not all these medications are really appropriate or appropriate to really initiate. I think that number one and number two medications that should be used on a regular basis are Tylenol and NSAIDs. And obviously, they have their own complications. I think probably the most benign out of all of them is acetaminophen. It's used pretty much like water, but I'm sure you've heard from your patients, oh, I've taken Tylenol, it does nothing for me. So acetaminophen indications for it are fever, joint pain, osteoarthritis, myofascial pain, headaches, anything you can possibly imagine. The exact mechanism to Tylenol to this date is still unknown, but they think that the reason it works is on the COX-2 inhibitor. Ways that you can get acetaminophen, obviously if someone is taking oral medication, there's no reason that they can't take oral Tylenol. I don't know why everybody's in a rush. Everything has to be given IV. If someone can swallow water, they're eating their breakfast, they can take oral medications. Obviously, the bioavailability of acetaminophen is drastically different from taking it orally versus taking it IV. If you take an oral medication, roughly a third to half of it is automatically transformed in the liver. So 650 milligrams, you're really only getting maybe somewhere between 300 to 400 milligrams into the bloodstream right away. When I was a resident, we had this great product come out, Ofirmev. Ofirmev came to market under Cadence Pharmaceuticals. Dosage back in 2011 was probably about $7 to $10, and now that it's under Mallinckrodt, it's probably somewhere between $40 to $60 a dose. So that's really changed things. I know here in the hospital, our formulary is that it's reserved for intra-op and PACU use, but in extreme cases, I have asked them, and they will extend that onto the floor as well, too. But again, use it judiciously. It's not just for every patient out there. It's your patient that has severe pain that maybe can't take oral medications or that other medications are not appropriate for them. Adverse effects, nausea, vomiting, pruritus, Stevens-Johnson, and obviously the hepatotoxic issues with more than 3 to 4 milligrams a day of acetaminophen. When I was a resident, Tylenol came out with a recommendation that it should be no more than 3 grams. And the reason why is that most people were taking more than 3 grams a day. Most likely they were taking almost 4 grams a day. So as a protection, they reduced it just empirically down to 3 grams a day. NSAIDs, joint pain, osteoarthritis, lumbar disc herniation, myofascial pain, headaches. You can use it pretty much, again, for everything. The exact mechanism is COX-1 and COX-2. Obviously, celecoxib is a COX-2-specific inhibitor. That's pretty much the only COX-2-selective inhibitor that we have on the market now. Here's a table, more or less, of equipotent NSAIDs that we have readily available, from aspirin to ibuprofen, naproxen, ketoprofen, which you don't see too much floating around, diclofenac, meloxicam, and celecoxib. I didn't put a toradol on here. Roughly about 15 to 30 milligrams IV is about equipotent dose as well, too. Ketorolac is very, very cheap, well under $1 a dose. You want to limit the dosages of it because it can cause some renal impairment. The FDA, after the whole study with Vioxx, I'm sure some people remember that. Bextra is another drug that was a COX-2-specific inhibitor. They saw that there was an increase of cardiovascular events with those patients, and they thought it was specific to those drugs. It turns out that all COX-1 and COX-2 inhibitors have that same side effect. So the FDA put a warning on all NSAIDs after really looking at the data, even though they took those drugs off the market. They worked really well, and probably was no different than what we see with Celebrex. And they say there is a potential serious cardiovascular event and serious and potential life-threatening GI adverse events associated with the use of this drug class. Now, if your patient takes Celebrex or ibuprofen on a regular basis, for some reason everybody thinks they have to take a prescription dose of ibuprofen. I hear people saying, oh, I need to take 600, I need to take 800 milligrams, it's the only thing that works for me. There's really no difference in giving someone 400 milligrams of ibuprofen or 800. So why give them 800, have to worry about getting the GERD, gastric ulcers, all these really terrible side effects. So I in my own practice, I limit everybody to 400 milligrams at most of ibuprofen. There's no reason to take that a few times a day, but they shouldn't be using it sequentially every day forever and ever. I've seen people get gastric ulcers, gastric perforations, going to acute kidney injury from this medications. It's very serious. And most of these patients, they think it's over-the-counter and that over-the-counter medications have no side effects and they can never affect them. Same thing with Tylenol and NSAIDs. So again, you got to educate patients about it. Next class of medications that I use often on a regular basis are the neuroleptic medications. I use this a lot for neuropathic pain. Patients will say, oh, I have this burning sensation. You can see this in diabetic patients, cancer patients after they have chemotherapy, HIV patients after they've been on the retroviral medications for years, CRPS, which used to be called RSD, reflex sympathetic dystrophy, which is now called complex regional pain syndrome. And I've seen an abundant amount of peripheral neuropathy here in South Florida of an unknown etiology. I don't know what it is, but a lot of 60 and 70-year-old patients, they say, I just have tingling in my fingers and my toes. They're not diabetic. They never had cancer. They don't have HIV. And nobody can really figure out why they have neuropathy, but this medication works really well for them. Now, the medication gabapentin, you would think that it works at the GABA receptor, but it actually works at the calcium channel. And this is a question that often pops up in a lot of different boards. On the pain medicine board, it was like a routine question they like to test people on. So remember, gabapentin does not work at the GABA receptor. It works at the calcium channel. Topiramate works at the GABA receptor itself. Gabapentin, I used to start patients at 300 milligrams of gabapentin. And then I had a lot of people complaining about that it was too sedating to them. They were getting swelling in their legs. I reduced it down to 100 milligrams, and then everyone was saying that it wasn't working for them. I think 200 milligrams is pretty much the sweet spot, especially the patient population around Boca. It's a much older patient population. Their ability to clear these medications is significantly reduced than the much younger population. So I think 200 milligrams seems to fit the bill here. Lyrica, I start patients mostly at 50 to 75 milligrams, sometimes once a day, sometimes twice a day. Oftentimes, I use it as a PRN medication. I find that gabapentin is you have to get a therapeutic level in their body, and then they start to get good pain relief, whereas Lyrica, as soon as they take it, 30 to 45 minutes later, they're feeling pretty good from it. Topamax, I start patients at 25 milligrams a day, and the max is 2 to 400 milligrams a day. Most common side effects of the anticonvulsants is they can have sedation, dizziness, ataxia, weight gain. I usually find that most of my patients complain that they feel a little fuzzy in their head, and if they use it chronically, they'll get some peripheral edema in their lower extremities. Next class of medications that I kind of grouped all together, because they all pretty much do the same thing, is the tricyclic acids, the SSRIs, and the SNRIs. They all kind of work a little bit differently, and they evolved that TCAs have been around for a long, long time. They used to be the standard of care for antidepressant, and I consider it more of a dirty type of medication, meaning it works at a bunch of different receptors, whereas the SSRIs and the SNRIs are much more specific and have been found to have not as much complications, and we'll talk about the complications about each one of them here. So TCAs, diabetic neuropathy pain you can use for, CRPS, chronic headache, post-stroke pain, radicular pain, and it basically lengthens the amount of time that the serotonin and norepinephrine are in the synaptic cleft, which sounds similar to SNRIs and SSRIs, but we don't really know exactly all the receptors that it quite works at here. Most common one is that we see on the market is amitriptyline. You also see nortriptyline on the market as well, too. The other ones have pretty much fallen out of favor here. Again, in medical school, you learn about all the anticholinergic side effects, hot as a hair, blind as a bat, dry as a bone, red as a beet, mad as a mad hatter. It increases the patient's temperature. They get dilated pupils. It blurs their vision. They get dry mouth. A lot of the older men will say they have urinary retention from it. They'll feel a little flushed. They'll feel confused. They'll be a little delirious. They don't like these symptoms, especially, again, the patient population here around Boca Raton, they are going to be much more predisposed to these side effects. So I don't think that they're great medications to be on. You may have some patients that come in and say, I've been on this medication for 100 years, I want to stay on it, this is what I take, then that's fine. But there's really no reason to start a patient on one of these older type of medications because of these side effects here. SSRIs probably came to market maybe 20, 30 years ago now, used for depression. You can use it for chronic pain, increases the amount of serotonin, again, in that synaptic cleft. Most of them are now generic, citalopram, fluoxetine, which was Prozac, sertraline, which is Zoloft, and they can be titrated as an outpatient. This is really not a medication that can be utilized as an inpatient unless they were on it pre-existingly. Most common side effects is, for especially a lot of men, will complain about decreased libido and impotence. They'll have maybe some palpitations in their heart. If you give them too much of this, they can get a serotonin syndrome, and they can get SIADH from it. SNRIs, which are probably the most common medication used for depression, anxiety, increases both the serotonin and norepinephrine in the synaptic cleft, has much fewer side effects as compared to the predecessors of the SSRIs, but it all depends on the patient. Some respond better more to one than they do the other. Most common ones that we see are bupropion, which is Wellbutrin, duloxetine, which is Cymbalta. Both, I believe, are now on the generic market. Most common side effects that you see from it are nausea, vomiting, constipation. You can get some withdrawal symptoms if you suddenly stop it with a medication like duloxetine. The recommendation is that you start a patient at 30 milligrams, you slowly titrate them up to 60 milligrams, and you should never abruptly stop them from it because they can get with some withdrawal symptoms from it. And if you give them too much of it, again, you can get serotonin syndrome. I really like muscle relaxants a lot. If you've seen any of the consults I do in the hospital, a lot of patients will complain about kind of these very non-specific pain. You have to remember, your patients have had either major surgery, they've been laying in a hospital bed. Has anybody laid in a hospital bed here? Anybody? Anybody? We see one. Any of the residents? Any residents actually laid in a hospital bed? Yeah, they're super uncomfortable. when I was a resident, whenever I had time to sleep, I'd sleep in whatever vacant part of the hospital there was. Usually the hospital beds were the most comfortable ones, but they're terrible. They're absolutely terrible. And if you had a patient that's been in the hospital for 2-3 days, yeah, of course their back is going to hurt because they're not sleeping on their Sealy Posturepedic or their foam mattress. These are basically plastic that they're sleeping on all night long. They have the lights going on and off, the sounds, the beeping. They're not getting a good quality of sleep. So there's a lot of predisposing factors of why they're going to feel like garbage the next day. So that's why I tend to use a lot of muscle relaxers. Just getting a little bit of the ache and pain away sometimes helps them feel much more comfortable. Three most common types of muscle relaxers that I use are tizanidine, which works at the alpha-2 receptor, cyclobenzaprine, which is basically a centrally acting muscle relaxer. It just relaxes the muscle, and then baclofen, which works at the GABA-B receptor. Cyclobenzaprine, if you go into Cerner here and you click that you want to put a patient on cyclobenzaprine for some reason, it wants to give you 10 milligrams. I think 10 milligrams is a bit of a high dose to start someone on. I think 5 milligrams is more than appropriate for these patients. Second type of medication I use is tizanidine. And then really the court of last resort is baclofen. And we'll go into the specifics why I think some are better than the other. So this is a broad list of all these medications of their side effects: constipation, nausea, dizziness, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, which is specific to cyclobenzaprine, hypotension, which is specific to all of them, but more so with tizanidine, and you can get withdrawal symptoms from baclofen. I find that cyclobenzaprine is the least benign out of all the muscle relaxers, but for some reason CMS, Medicare for the residents here, has deemed cyclobenzaprine as a high-risk medication. I don't know why that is. I think that it's actually safer than the other ones. But anytime you send a prescription to any patient that's a Medicare recipient, it always bounces back as that it's a high-risk medication, and doctor, do you really want to keep your patient on this? And of course, I want to keep the patient on it. I experimented with tizanidine a little bit with a lot of patients, and I found that it caused too much hypotension. And I get too many phone calls from the nurses on the floor that your patient has a low blood pressure and we should stop the tizanidine. So I've pretty much stopped using that. But I do find that it does work a little bit in the supratentorial region for a lot of patients, and it helps to calm some anxiety that they may have. So I think it does have some role in the utilization. Baclofen, I really reserve that for anybody who has spasticity. Specifically, you can see that with any type of CP patients, cerebral palsy patients, spinal cord injury patients, they'll be very spastic, they'll be very rigid, and I find that the baclofen kind of eases the muscles much more. It works a little bit better than the other ones. Now, with all these medications, there's also interventional pain management. In the hospital, my practice is very much medication-based, whereas my outpatient practice is much more interventional-based. Again, you saw all these medications. They have tons of side effects. They all have adverse things that can affect patients. And there serves a role for using medication, and then there serves a role for interventional pain management. Now, some of these interventional things can be done as an inpatient. If someone comes in and they have an acute disc herniation, they have radiculopathy, they don't want to go undergo surgery, and you're having a hard time control their pain, an epidural steroid injection is very feasible. There have been plenty of inpatients that have done that on. It's really not that big of a deal to facilitate that, so that is an option as well, too. Another option for interventional treatment is facet blocks. That's, again, treating the osteoarthritis that develops in the facet joints, and usually they'll complain about pure axial pain. Radiofrequency is a more permanent solution. Again, that's an outpatient type of thing. You can inject any type of the joints. The more sophisticated types of things are spinal cord stimulation for someone who's had prior surgery or has pretty bad peripheral neuropathy, has been refractory to all things. And then what's kind of fallen out of favor is intrathecal pumps. So when intrathecal pumps first came to market, it was really a thing designed for someone who has 4 to 6 months to live with some type of severe cancer diagnosis. We have used that for CP patients that have pretty severe spasticity, and that it can provide baclofen directly into the cerebral spinal fluid. But over the last probably 10 or 15 years, a lot of people started implanting these devices for use of chronic opioids. I don't really agree with it, but that's kind of where things have gone. The reimbursement has dramatically changed with intrathecal pumps, so it's really fallen out of the favor probably in the last 5 years or so. So you may have a few of them. I've seen a few of them probably in the last year pop up in the hospital, but it's not a huge market like it used to be. So an epidural, it's kind of a basic thing here. No one really understands it. So basically, there you have the dura, which is the covering of the spinal cord. We're basically going in that space right above the dura there. The epidural that I do for pain management is really no different than we do for OB. The technique and how we inject people and what we're injecting in that space is different. But overall, the mechanism and how things are working is pretty much the same thing. There's a few different approaches that we can do for it. Here's what a facet injection looks like. You go directly right by the facet joint. You inject some steroids, some local anesthetic. It goes into the joint, and it helps to alleviate some of that osteoarthritis that may have built up in that area. Spinal cord stimulation. Again, you may have seen quite a few patients that have popped up with that in the inpatient side. This is basically what it is. Mechanically, it's really no different than a pacemaker or defibrillator. The same companies that make those devices are the same ones that make the spinal cord stimulators. The application is a little bit different. The battery is pretty much the same. The wires are pretty much the same, except with the electrodes at the end. Goes into the spinal cord area, and it augments the signal that comes from the lower part of the spinal cord that goes up to the brain. So you're really not changing what the generator is, you're changing that signal pattern that goes from the low back or in the neck area up to the brain, so that what may be interpreted as a unpleasant stimulus now turns into a pleasant stimulus for patients here. This is basically what the device looks like here. These are two different companies. One is Boston, one is Medtronic here. These are the wires that go into the epidural space. You can see these little electrodes here. This is the battery. It looks pretty much what a pacemaker and defibrillator battery are, and they have basically a controller to control the mechanism. That's pretty much it. Any questions?
What are your thoughts on using a benzo as adjunct for someone who's pain, not
So I have seen quite a bit of that. You know, benzodiazepines do cause muscle relaxation, but again, I'm worried about putting people on medications that if you put them on a regimen of it, you can't just abruptly stop benzodiazepines. You can go into a benzo withdrawal. It pops up on E-Force. You can. I like to get people on regimens while they're in the hospital or in my office so that if they need to continue it, it's a medication that can continue on a long-term basis. I see so many people on benzodiazepines now. I mean, a ridiculous amount. They get over-medicated with these medications as they age. I think the creatinine clearance and their kidney functioning is not working as well. And what they took, you know, 2 milligrams or 5 milligrams just a few years ago, it's over-sedating them. It's kind of them making them think a little bit funny. So I personally don't like people being on medication for pain that's on a regular basis. You know, there's always, you know, the certain circumstances that I like them to be on that because their pain is just so severe. But the majority of patients, I don't. And now that we have all this regulation that's going on, I mean, especially for the non-pain specialists in the crowd, if you have to be doing, you have to have them sign an opioid agreement, which pretty much translates to benzodiazepines. You got to be checking E-Force on them. It's very stringent.
Can you comment on the use of TCAs, SSRIs, and SNRIs in post-surgical patients? Any utility, overkill?
Again, I see those as more of long-term medications that people need to be on. And I have had some few patients that are on it from 3 to 6 months at a time after maybe the pain has been very severe, they develop some anxiety and depression. That's kind of a vicious cycle. You know, when people develop pretty severe medical conditions and they get such severe pain, it makes them feel anxious and depressed. So kind of using that medication to get them over that hump, I see no problem with that. And I think it works really well for that. But in the acute phase after someone has had some type of major surgery, I don't think it's going to really be of much benefit to them. That severe surgical-related type of pain, I think that the other class of medications, the Tylenols, the NSAIDs, if the surgeons are okay with it, some opioid medication, maybe some muscle relaxer for a few days, and that really helps to alleviate the pain very quickly and doesn't necessitate the patient continuing those medications for a long time. Well, first thing is I always decrease dosages for people before turning off because, I see a wide variety of dosing for this. Some physicians will write high doses and start patients on it, and then the patients will say, oh, I had a terrible side effect. It didn't work for me. I felt like garbage. When reality is they should have been on a lower dose, and it would have been much more optimal for them. The most common thing that I see is with gabapentin is that some patients will start gabapentin at 300 milligrams, maybe three times a day. And they'll say, oh, it didn't work for me. I felt like garbage like that. And I kind of plead with them, why don't we try at a much lower dose, maybe not three times a day, maybe once or twice a day. And I've had pretty good success with it. So every patient is not, these are kind of, you know, guidelines about what dosage to start with people. But I think the first thing with all medications, always try decreasing the dose before terminating it if they're having the side effects. And sometimes you can get pretty good control of their pain. They're not feeling so much of those side effects before just immediately terminating things.
Something that you didn't mention, but how about local anesthetic patches and those kind of things?
They do. Unfortunately, a lot of the insurers are not covering it. Specifically, lidoderm patches, they've restricted that to postherpetic neuralgia. There's one other indication. I'm blanking on it off the top of my head. But if you don't have that diagnosis, they will not cover it. And they're expensive. Lidoderm patches are several hundreds of dollars. You can get over-the-counter lidocaine patches. If the pharmacies carry it, it's usually at like 3 to 4%. It's never the 5%. I think it works somewhat decently. But it's basically local anesthetic that's seeping into the skin. Maybe it's working right at the point where you're putting it in. I'm willing to wager a lot of it's being taken up systemically. And I've really never seen it help someone tremendously. You know, if you're trying to deal with some super tentorial issues, I think that it is feasible to use it. And if the patients say it works for them, I think it's a relatively benign thing. But it's not something that I use on a regular basis. I personally am not. I have my own thoughts and feelings about it, but there are a lot of people that are looking into this stuff. I have more patients than ever on this CBD oil. Half of my patients say it does something for them. Half of them says it does nothing for them. I think it's based on that, just anecdotally in my own practice, I think it's a placebo effect. But the government and society, they really want marijuana. They want marijuana for recreational purposes. They want it for medicinal purposes. There really isn't a lot of study that's been done on this stuff. Again, the studies that are present out there, they're on 20, 30 patients. I don't know any study or medical data that we can accept today based on 20 or 30 patients. I think that's a little premature to accept that within the medical community. You know, once they study on hundreds if not thousands of people and there's real data to support it, at the end of the day, we do know it works at the cannabinoid receptor, and I think there is definitely some utility to help control pain. But the question is marijuana, is THC, is CBD oil, is that the appropriate thing to trigger that receptor? I don't know, but we're just at the infantile. I wouldn't even say infantile. We were at the basically the conception state of it. And we still need a lot more data to really see where this is kind of all going. I mean, anytime you trigger any of the mu receptors, it creates a euphoria that I think no matter which one it is, because there's a variety of mu receptors, I think they're all addicting. And the rates of addiction, when I was a resident, we used to think, oh, it takes a week or two to become addicted, and now they're thinking maybe it really takes only a few days. I mean, these are very powerful medications that people develop this euphoria that they don't feel with any other medication. So on one hand, yes, the mu receptor works very well, but I don't think it's the receptor we should be triggering to controlling chronic pain. Now, acute pain, that's totally different. I think it's, you know, we only have so many tools in our tool belt, and I think it's appropriate. But for long-term pain, not a great strategy.
So I think that's probably what you're thinking about. And I actually had one of those programs in the office, and they're effective, but what they literally do is you block your pain, so therefore you can put your hand on a hot stove and not know you're burning yourself. So there's safety issues with these things. Just to back up from like the lighter on patches, I agree with you, lighter on the patches. I never had to wear the results and I think it's more placebo. But two questions.
Sure. So the issue with compounding, the number one issue I see with it is a financial issue. Is a lot of the insurances do not cover it. It's very expensive. I think there was a whole scandal within the VA system where they were sending it to all these veterans and the government was being charged like $1,000 for a tube of this cream. They're basically compounded from a pharmacy. So a pharmacy will take, let's say, gabapentin, maybe some ketamine, maybe some diclofenac, mix it up into some type of cream, and then you rub it onto your skin. Now the question is it really beneficial to patients? So first of all, it's got to cross the skin barrier. If it crosses the skin barrier, that means that it can get into the vascular system, which means it is being taken up systemically. Is it working at the site of action? Probably. But the real utility of it, I haven't had too much success with it, but I also haven't used it a lot because it's not covered by most of the insurers. I think we really need to study this to see if it works, it doesn't work, and then determine, should we really be providing this to people? The cost of $1,000 a tube for basically some lotion that has gabapentin and ketamine, I don't think $1,000 is really warranted. I think these are pretty cheap things to get. There's diclofenac comes in a cream, I know. I think gabapentin you can get readily available. If you really want to get it systemically, you got to take it orally. If you're going to use it locally, I'm leery about it really penetrating to those receptors and working where it is. I think, I hate to say it, but I think it's more of a placebo effect for a lot of people. And what was the second? So I'll give you two kind of scenarios here. So let's say someone comes in and they're in, they've had a, let's say, a knee replacement, and they have terrible pain. The pain's not really well controlled. Is it appropriate to do any type of these interventional treatments? No. I mean, this is an acute thing. It's something that will probably get better within a couple of weeks. They need to get into physical therapy. They need to let their wounds heal, their muscles heal, the skin heal, and they're going to feel much better. Now, on the other hand, if you have a patient that comes in and they have lumbar spinal stenosis, where it's basically narrowing of the canal where the spinal cord sits, and they have radiculopathy. They come in and say, my back hurts, my butt hurts, shooting down my leg. They're 75 years old. They have hypertension. They have high cholesterol. Maybe they have a stent in, and they have a history of gastric ulcers. Yeah, medication is really not appropriate for them because of all these terrible side effects that we had. And maybe an epidural steroid injection is more appropriate for them. Overall, I find that most patients are they're much more educated than they were than compared to my younger days of medicine. The amount of information that's readily available is much more, and that has a double-edged sword. But on the other hand, they don't want to be dependent on medications. They don't want to have to always take a pill. Every time I'm in pain, I got to take a pill. If they can get an injection once a year, twice a year, even maybe three times a year, and helps to control their pain, they don't have to take any of these medications. They can do their activities of daily living. I don't expect a 75-year-old to run a marathon, but I certainly expect them to get up, walk around, swim, bike, play cards with their friends. I think that that's a much safer alternative. You know, all these interventional treatments, if done by someone who's appropriate, that is well-trained and knows what they're doing, the chances of major side effects from them are pretty low. Chances of major neurological issues after an epidural, maybe when I was a resident, was maybe 1 in 100,000. I'm willing to wager it's probably somewhere between 1 in 250,000, maybe 1 in 500,000. It's a relatively low risk procedure. Again, in the right patient, done by the right type of person that is trained in what they're doing. But I think that all these medications, I've seen all these side effects. They're real. They're not like, you know, you just don't look them up and up today and think, oh, you know, it can cause this, it can cause this, I don't have to worry about it. I've seen, I'd say, probably 50% of these side effects at some point in my training or career. So it's real. It's not made up. And unfortunately, there are side effects from the interventional treatments as well, too, but they're of much lower incidence. So, physical therapy. If someone has a good functioning heart, they got good functioning lungs, if they don't have a major fracture or they haven't undergone some major surgery in, let's say, 8 weeks prior, there's no reason that people can't do physical therapy. Just because you're 75 years old and you have spinal stenosis, it doesn't mean that you can't function. You should be able to get up and walk around. Again, I don't know what it is with patients. They think that if they feel hurt, they should lay in bed for 3 days. And we all know that if you lay in bed, every day you lay in bed, you lose 3% of your muscle mass. So compound that every 3 days, that's a lot of muscle mass you're going to lose. I mean, it's real. Everybody should get up and walk around and move. Nature has a philosophy, either you use it or you lose it. And I've seen remarkable things. I sent a lot of people to physical therapy that have been in really bad condition. A few months of physical therapy and a good physical therapist. You know, physical therapy is not you go and you lay on a table, someone massages you, puts some heat on your back, and, you know, magically gets you better. Physical therapy, it's physical. So I did my fellowship in Boston, and there's this program up at New England Baptist. They call it the boot camp program. And basically, they guarantee if you stick to this program, you will be able to do a back extension with your entire body weight on a machine. So if you weigh 150 pounds, you're going to do a back extension at 150 pounds. And you basically take to someone who's extremely debilitated, not because of some, you know, maybe they have some degenerative pattern, they had some traumatic event, but their body has become basically deconditioned. And it trains them to overcome their fears, their physical limitations, and getting them back to a functional state. I've seen a lot of people down here who I was really worried about in a bad situation, send them to physical therapy. They come back in my office 3 months later. They're not walking with the walker anymore. They are smiling. They're happy. And it's hard work. It's not just, if any of you were at my presentation before, American society, they want the quick fix for everything. They want the quick fix for dieting, for pain, you name it. They want to be able to take a pill and just magically feel better. But that's not the reality of it. The more you put into physical therapies, the more you get out of it. As a physician, I coach them about that. I set that precedent to them about it. Because if the doctor tells you to do it, there are some patients that still listen to their doctor, surprisingly. But there are some. And I find that the ones that listen to me and go into physical therapy with that mentality, they're going to have much better outcomes from it. Residents, any questions? Okay, thank you.